Myrtle Beach is the beach. 60 miles of bright sand, water, and a wealth of wonderful music playing day and night. You can step into a simple beach bar and discover a surprising level of exciting musical talent. A place to kick back and groove to the enticing soundtrack of the most unexpected vacations around. With nothing but good vibes floating through the warm ocean air. Plan your own music-filled trip to America's Jukebox at visitmyrtlebeach.com.
Life is a highway, and on it there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy, so go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.
And now, prepare yourself for the only talk radio show you'll want to turn up.
Crank this thing.
Sirius XM Pandora presents the place where your hard rock and metal voice can still be heard.
You bet your ass, baby.
Unfiltered, uncensored, say whatever you want.
Hit the record button. Anything can happen, you know?
I know that ain't nobody out there came to be mellow tonight, now did you? I say there ain't nobody. I say there ain't nobody not out there that even wants to be a little bit mellow. Now is there? Anybody wants to get mellow, you can turn around and get the fuck out of here, all right?
This is the Trunk Nation Podcast. With host Eddie Trunk.
Welcome, everybody, to another episode of the Eddie Trunk Podcast. New every Thursday, wherever you get your podcast. Thank you so much for downloading, subscribing, streaming, and checking it out, bringing you in-depth interviews with some of your favorite artists each and every week. And we appreciate you listening wherever you get the Eddie Trunk Podcast around the world. Thank you so much for checking it out. Hope you enjoyed everything coming your way. Last week, Lita Ford, Steve Whiteman, some great stuff going on. And this week is no exception, because this week I've got a great interview. And it's in-depth, and it's long, and you're going to love it, with one of the noted producers in the history of hard rock and metal music, and that is Max Norman. I love talking to the producers. You get insights and stories from them that you rarely get from nobody else, and they're always fun to visit with and get those stories out of, and Max was no exception. Now, I've known Max for a long time, and he was very generous with his time. He kind of got out of producing records for a long time, and then recently is starting to get back into it again. And he, as I've said many times to a lot of my audience, if you're a hard rock fan, you'd be hard-pressed to not have at least a couple records in your collection that Max Norman produced, namely Blizzard of Oz and Diary of a Madman. We can start there. So a lot of the interview you're about to hear focuses on the Randy Ozzy records, also a little bit on Bark at the Moon. You also get some Megadeth stuff in here, Lynch Mob stuff, Y&T. The resume is so extensive, I couldn't get to everything in depth, but there's some great, great insights that you are not going to want to miss, and you are going to be, I'm sure, riveted. So I was. I mean, I love talking to Max, and he's a great guy, and he brings in, he's great with his stories and his insights about rock music. For instance, like you're going to hear in this interview how the I in the beginning of Crazy Train happened. I never knew that story. You'll hear it from the man who produced the record. Or did he produce the record? He has an interesting take on that too that I think you're going to enjoy. Max Norman, full extensive interview for you here this week on the Eddie Trunk Podcast. And again, as I tell you every week, the podcast you are hearing, the interview you're about to hear, happened live on my Sirius XM radio show. If you're in the U.S. or Canada, please join me. It's called Trunk Nation. It's on Monday through Friday, live, 2 to 4 p.m. Eastern time every day. Nightly re-airs 10 to midnight Eastern. And you can also catch replays and listen on demand anytime you want on the Sirius XM app. If you are only listening to this podcast and you're in the U.S. or Canada, you're getting like 1/6 of what I do on a weekly basis on the radio. So please do join me and come on board if you're not already and listen to me on volume on 106. There's also a 6th radio show on Mondays, 5 to 8 p.m. Eastern on Hair Nation. And also, there is a terrestrial radio show on about 30 radio stations across America. Thank you all for your support and for listening, whatever you listen to, whenever you do. Also, don't forget social media at Eddie Trunk, Twitter, Instagram, fan page on Facebook. EddieTrunk.com is the official online home. Twitter and Instagram is where I am the most active. If you're interested in a personalized video, go to cameo.com. Search my name and find my profile. Happy to make a video for you or someone you would like to send one to. I think that covers it for the most part. This is an extensive interview, so let's get to it right now. Without further ado, let's get to it. Producer Max Norman, he is my guest on the Eddie Trunk podcast this week. Enjoy. And it is a great pleasure to be joined by my guest on our latest producer special. This is a guy that has been on this show a few times in the past and has always been nice enough to offer us some insights. A couple times we had him in the studio, but I have never yet dedicated a whole show to him where we really get into his career and his entire history. And if you are a fan of hard rock music, there is no way you don't have one of his records or several of the records he's worked on in your collection. It is producer Max Norman joining us right now on Trunk Nation. Max, thank you for the time. How you been?
Everything's very good, very good. Thank you very much, and always nice to talk to you again, Eddie. Very good. I see you've been busy out in Vegas there building a house. That's nice.
Yeah. Just trying to start to think about my retirement plan and my escape plan, Max. We all need
one.
Oh
my God! Already? Oh my God! I must be a bit late on that one. I am kind of working on mine too. So you're right. Yeah.
Exactly. I mean, just thinking ahead a little bit, not imminently, but it's nice to think ahead and have a bit of a plan. So we'll see how it goes. But yes, I've always loved that city, and there's a lot of rock and roll in that city right now. So it's a fun place to be, no doubt.
I wanted to, when
I do these things, Max, before we get into your discography and all the artists that you worked with and some stories there, you know, I always love to ask producers this question to start, and that is, where did it all start for you? Because the path that producers have taken to become producers is often pretty interesting, whether they were musicians themselves or live engineers or whatever the case may be, how they got into that world. So for you, I imagine growing up in England as a kid, you found a path that took you into producing records. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
When I was in my teens, I was in a couple of bands. And it was very difficult in those days to get anything done. It was like, first of all, it was difficult to afford the equipment. And then it was all about trying to find somebody who had a van. And then usually the guy with the van didn't play very well. So, you know, it was a bit of a, you know, so there were lots of things in the way. So I did play for quite a long time, but when I was about 17, 18, I went to Germany. I answered an advert in the New Musical Express, which you probably have heard of.
NME, sure.
There was an advert. They used to have adverts in the back for roadies and you know, all kinds of different jobs and stuff like that. And there was an advert for a sound guy for a German band called Wind. And I didn't really know how to do it. I'd done a couple of gigs with the original Skid Row, actually, the one with Brendan Shields and Noel Bridgman and Gary Moore.
You were in that band? Max, you were in that band?
No. I did sound
for sound.
A couple of shows doing sound for them. And that's kind of got me interested in the sound thing. And Gary was just a blinding at that time, by the way. He was like that. I'd never seen anything like him. He was just 18. So
I was going to ask you about that. Just for people listening that don't understand, there was a band called Skid Row in the UK, nothing to do with the Skid Row people know in America. And Gary Moore was in that band as a very young kid. And yeah, I would imagine, I mean, I think Gary's unbelievably underrated in the U.S. I certainly know who he is, and I'm a fan. And, of course, he passed away a number of years ago. But even at 18 years old, he was a phenom, huh?
Yeah, the interesting thing was I had bought from my local music store a 59 Les Paul Special. And this would be, I suppose, I'm trying to think what year this was. But anyway, went to see Skid Row, the original first Skid Row from Ireland, of course. And it was in Wellingborough in Northamptonshire, and I took the Les Paul with me and showed it to Gary in the dressing room. And he picked it up, and it just became a totally different guitar. And I was astonished by this, actually. This was a very germane sort of revelation for me. And I just looked at him, and the whole guitar just changed character totally, and it became Gary. And that's when I realized that, you know, it has nothing to do with the guitar, and it has nothing to do with the amp or the boost boxes or the stomp boxes or the chip pans and all this other stuff. It's really all about the guy's fingers, you know, all about how the guy plays. And this really was a revelation to me. I suppose I was about 17 maybe. And so I helped out doing sound with them for a couple of gigs. And then the band thing was very difficult, doing the playing thing. So I decided to answer an advert in the NME to go to Germany and worked for a band there called Wind. And this was in the very early days of big shows. And we had a WEM PA, a Watkins Electronic Music, WEM, as a British company that was quite big at the time, disappeared now, but probably will come back at some point, like Vox and, you know, some of these older Hi-Watt and some of these older brands. It'll probably come back. But anyway, we had... the mixers were five-channel mixers. They had five channels on mixers, and we had three of those. They were called Audio Masters, WEM Audio Masters. We had three of those, and one of the things I said to the guy when I got there was, I looked at the jack plugs that went into the mixer, and they were stereo jack plugs. They had a tip and a ring, and then a sleeve, and I was like, well, this is kind of weird. And he said, oh, yeah, they're balanced. So I was, balance. And of course, in those days, there wasn't any internet. So I had to, you know, I had to try and figure this out. And I actually had a couple of electronics books, and I looked this up, and I realized that low impedance balance was how they ran microphones down long cables. So anyway, all these things started to impinge upon me. And I worked with Wind, I think, for about 4 months out in Germany, touring Germany. In the winter months, which wasn't any fun at all. Mm. But I did grow some muscles and learn to drive a big Mercedes truck. And so that's how it all really kind of started.
Let me jump in, Max, let me jump in there because I'm curious about something. So going back a little bit, you said that you initially started doing some sound for Gary Moore or for Skid Row, the band that Gary was in at the time. But how do you even do that? In other words, as a young kid, getting behind a desk for a live show, are you just at that point learning on the fly and I'll turn this knob and that sounds good? Or did you have a mentor? Did you have somebody to tell you that's how you set up your console?
At that point, no. And the consoles were really just basically probably three or four volume controls. I mean, it was very, very, when I say I was doing the front of house, I mean, it was really just kind of turning up the volume, basically, you know, very, very rudimentary.
So not much different than running an equalizer on a stereo or something. You're just fiddling with buttons and balancing what you think sounds good.
Yeah. I mean, you know, we probably only had, three or four microphones, you know, so, you know, there'd be a kick mic and a snare mic and possibly a bass DI and possibly a mic on the guitar, and then maybe a couple of, you know, vocal mics, you know. So it was really very, very simple system, maybe four to six mics at the most. So did you
have a mentor as far as an engineer and producer, or did you go to any sort of actual proper schooling for it, or did you just learn on the fly?
No, before this, the reason that I understood what was going on a little more than probably some other people was that when I was about 12, 13, 14, I had a four-track at home, and an Akai four-track that you could do sound on sound with, which was a very early kind of sync you know, being able to play along with something. So I was able to put a track on there with a guitar and then play along with it, you know, basically do an overdub. So I was already kind of familiar with a basic kind of some of these basic, you know, tenets, like, you know, you need a wire from A to B for it to work, stuff like, you know, stuff like that, you know, that you know. So as it went on, I learned more about this. But I did have a mentor later on. Right at that point, I did not. And I was basically doing the completion backward principle, which is like telling people that you can do it and then and then learning how to do it very quickly so that they don't find out, you know, and being very frightened that they're going to find out. And the frightened part being the impetus behind, you know, learning as fast as possible. So and I've used that many times, actually, in through life, and I found it to be quite a good block against, you know, not bothering to do stuff or not being able to do stuff. You know, you just tell people that you're going to do it, and then you're basically locked into it. You have to do it. And then, you know, and then basically if you don't know how to do it, you've got to learn right now, you know.
Reminds me of the phrase, fake it till you make it. You've heard that before, too, kind of similar to that.
Well, yeah, it's exactly it. Yeah, that's exactly it. Yeah, and it's surprisingly enough, I think a lot of people do that. And I think a lot of people, the good thing about that is that you can drop in there with no preconceptions. And so you can learn some bad habits, but you can learn some good ones, and you can be out of the box too. So, you know what I mean? That's, you know, like thinking out of the box. So it has pros and cons, and obviously, but later on, okay. So I worked for this band in Germany. And then, unfortunately, my brother was killed in a car crash when I was 20, and I came back. Oh, okay. So I was 19 when I went to Germany. So I came back to England for a few years after that. And then I worked for a cabaret band for a couple of years doing front of house sound. There was lots and lots of shows all over England. Working men's clubs and pubs and stuff like that, and then I got a couple of other different jobs doing like roadie stuff. I was a Manfred Mann's Earth Band spotlight operator for a little while. Mm-hmm. Moved through a few different fields. I did some backline stuff. I worked for Ginger Baker's Gervitz Army for a little while doing keyboards. Then I got an offer to join a sound company, Electrosound at that time, which was based in London. And then I did get a mentor, Mick Whelan, who was a very senior member of that company. No longer with that company. Now he works for a bunch of different stuff doing this. Just consultancy and stuff like that. But he was very knowledgeable. He's very knowledgeable about frequencies. And he had very good ears. He did sound for Robin Trower and the Beach Boys and a lot of big bands. And he was a great character, actually, because he wouldn't take any crap from anybody. I remember him telling, you know, Robin Trower. There was one show we were at. So I went on tour with Electrosound, and there was a show. The second show we did was Shea Stadium with Robin Trower. And this was all huge to me. You know, I was rigging the PA at this point. And I remember we did someplace in the Midwest. It was just like a big concrete tank. And Robin Trower and Jethro Tull 6040 co-bill. And this was one of the off days where we just did Robin. And it was probably about an 8,000-seater skating rink or one of these places, and we're just, you know, horrible, horrible acoustics. And I remember being there at the sound check, and Robin was up there playing, and they were going through a couple of the numbers, and I guess it was the Bridge of Sighs that was the album that they were doing. If you remember that,
sure.
With Jimmy playing bass and singing. What a great singer that guy was. And I thought Robin was looking out at the soundboard, and he's like peering out there, and Whelan is not out there. Mick Whelan's not out there. And finally Mick comes, mooching out from backstage, munching on his sandwich. And Travis just goes, Mick, what's going on? And Mick gets up to the soundboard and takes his time and he leans on the mic and goes, listen, if you want to play in a toilet, that's up to you. But don't expect me to make it sound any better. And everybody just froze. And I was like, holy crap. And that was the first time I'd ever heard anybody talk back to an artist like that.
Mm.
And you know, and you know what Travis just said? He just kind of went, okay. You know, that was the whole thing about Mick was he never ever took any crap from anybody, and that was another kind of lesson that I learned in the long run was he only grew in the stature of these guys, you know, because he wasn't a yes man at all, and he would say exactly what the truth was. He was exactly truthful, and I thought, you know what, that's really a fantastic thing, because I thought, he's going to shit can him right now. He's going to, like, fire him.
Right.
And of course, he didn't. He did the opposite. You know, he sort of drew him in even closer, you know, because there was the trust got established that he knew that Whelan would not lie to him. And this was another valuable lesson that I learned. I was like, you know what, that's really a great thing. And I decided then, I thought, you know what, there's no point in trying to yes your way out of it. If it sucks, it sucks. You just got to own up. And if it doesn't suck, you got to say, no, it doesn't suck. You know, so that whole truthful thing was another great lesson that I learned earlier on. And I thank Mick Whelan also my father was very, very adamant about, you know, never telling lies and just being a truthful, and, you know, and I always found that to be the case, you know.
So where does it transition into you making the jump into, well, what most people know you for, and the first things you worked on was obviously Blizzard of Oz for Ozzy. So where do we, how do we get there?
Okay, so I'm working for Electra Sound, and we're doing a lot of tours. I did a bunch of UI Heap tours with the late David Byron even, and Tufty Thompson, and a lot of these guys are gone now, of course, but did a lot of European tours, did some US tours, and one of the things that happened with Electrosound was that it joined up with Tom Fields Association from Boston and became an international company. And at the same time, we expanded in England and moved to South London, to a big place in South London, big factory. And we had a lot more lights going on. We were doing Kiss's Lights and Kiss's Sound. We were doing Bob Marley, doing a lot of big bands. And one of the things that would happen was I would go out on tours and be on tour with these lighting guys. And one of the guys I was on tour with I can't remember his name. Hang on. Anyway, the guy that owned Ridge Farm. So,
is this Chris Tangarides?
No. Chris didn't actually was just down there on the first album, and that didn't go that well for him, obviously. But it's Frank Andrews was the guy that owned the Ridge Farm, and his brother Tony had this new system that we were looking at called Turbo Sound. And Tony was the inventor of TurboSound, which is Frank's brother. And Frank owned Ridge Farm, and Tony lived on at Ridge Farm too. And they had a big, lot of stuff. They had a big workshop there, and had all kinds of stuff going on, two or three houses, and of course the studio. So, working with these guys as far as lighting goes, Frank said he had a guy down there with some stuff in the studio, just a small MCI setup, which was an old manufacturer of consoles and tape machines. And he had a JH 26 or something in there. And he wanted to buy equipment and put it in because the guy was basically splitting the deal with him and he wasn't making any money on it. So he wanted to put in a better console and a better 24 track and et cetera, et cetera. So I went down and spoke to Frank, and he started talking to me about it. And I said, look, I'll do the install and I'll put in all this stuff and do all the wiring if you let me be the resident engineer. Because I was about fed up, been on the road for about 7 years at this point. So I wanted to stop loading trucks and get into the studio, you know. So he agreed to that. So it took about 3 months to wire up the studio. And then we put in the second SSL 4000E series console in England. I think it was probably one of the first few that were built. I think the first one went into the Manor, which was Richard Branson's studio, Virgin Record studio at the time. And then the second one came down to us. And so I wired all this up and we put all this stuff in. And then lo and behold, people started showing up. And, you know, Ozzy was one of the first artists to show up there and book time. So I was there at the right time, at the right place, really.
It's Eddie Trunk. We'll be right back with more with Max Norman right after this.
Myrtle Beach is the beach. 60 miles of bright sand, water, and a wealth of wonderful music playing day and night. You can step into a simple beach bar and discover a surprising level of exciting musical talent. A place to kick back and groove to the enticing soundtrack of the most unexpected vacations around. With nothing but good vibes floating through the warm ocean air. Plan your own music-filled trip to America's jukebox at visitmyrtlebeach.com.
Want to make mom's day? Get to your Nordstrom Rack now and score amazing deals for Mother's Day, which is Sunday, May 12th. Find tons of gifts from only $30 at Nordstrom Rack. Fragrance, jewelry, luxury bags, activewear, beauty, and more. Save on Kate Spade New York, Stuart Weitzman, and Ted Baker London. Great brands, great prices. So shop your Nordstrom Rack store today and treat mom to the good stuff from just $30.
Start clean with Clorox, because Clorox delivers a powerful clean every time. Because messes happen. Because... I have a charcoal mask. Great, because why would I put that on my face when I could drop it in my sink? This is what I get for multitasking. Ugh, why is charcoal so sticky?
Hello?
Hey, Janice. I am so sorry. I thought I was on mute. No, we don't need to reschedule. I'll just stay off camera. Ooh, yeah, that happens. So start clean with Clorox. Use Clorox products as directed.
Life is a highway, and on it there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy, so go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.
Let's get back to more with my interview with Max Norman right now on the Eddie Trunk Podcast. Of course, your first production was Blizzard of Oz. What an amazing record, and an amazing record to have as the first on your list of credits. So talk about that, Max, because we mentioned Chris Tangarides earlier. Am I wrong in remembering that he was originally scheduled to produce that record?
Oh, no, that's correct. Yeah, he came down and with everything was set up, I think. And he's a lovely guy, Chris, and it's very sad that he's gone now. And I don't think this particularly affected his career that much. So, you know, fortunately, it was a sort of a, okay, it's not working, you know, see you later, basically. What happened was Chris came in, he put the drums down in, we had a stone room underneath the control room, which was like stone walls and concrete floor. And a concrete ceiling, but it was very low ceiling. It was probably only about 7 foot, maybe slightly over 7 feet high. So he put Lee down there with the drums.
Lee Kerslake, who did the drums on the first two records, and you're working.
Correct.
You're working as his engineer at this point on the Ozzy record.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
So we set him up down there, and I said, "Look, Chris," I said, "I got to say, I think it's a bad idea." And he said, "Oh yeah." He said, "Why is that?" I said, "Well, because as soon as he hits a cymbal, the whole room's just going to go nuts, you know." So I said, "That room is so live, and the ceiling is so low that you know it's going to be uncontrollable anyway." So anyway, he put him down there anyway, And it was pretty uncontrollable down there, and it was just lots of splashy stuff, and just everything was in every mic. And it was difficult to make kind of sense of it, and it didn't sound that good. And so what happened was, this is an old story, I've told this many times, but I'll tell it again just for you.
Oh, thank you.
What happened was, I was kind of horrified, because this was very soon after we built the studio, rebuilt the studio with a new console, new SSL, new Telefunken tape machine, blah, blah, blah. So I was kind of horrified, and I was like, oh, this can't be happening, you know. And so I said to Chris, I said, go down. I said, listen, you know, what, go down there, talk to him man to man, get the ideas through to them, whatever, you know. So he goes, oh, yeah, good idea. So he went downstairs to talk to them from the control room, and I closed the door control room, and I shut off all the headphones, and I rebalanced it real quick and tried to make it a little more controllable and not so, like, just because it just sounded like a mess. So I did that, and then the band would come up, and they would listen. They'd kind of nod around and be, okay, we've got to do this, we've got to do that, blah, blah, blah. And everything was okay for a few days, but unfortunately, Chris didn't seem to be getting it. So I was like, and I'm not sure if he even knew that I was changing the balance or whatever. But after about 4 days, I thought, you know, this is no good. I just can't keep doing this, you know. So I stopped doing it, actually. And so then after they would do a tape, they would come up and listen. And it would be Chris's mix, basically his rough mix, if you like. And they were kind of looking at each other, and everybody got very nervous. And I didn't really know what to do. And I was trying to do the best thing. And then I thought, you know, I really didn't know what to do. Anyway, so they all looked at each other after one take, and then they said, all right, well, you know, listen, we're going to take a break. We'll be back, you know, so. And then, so I was just sitting in the control room, kind of, you know, kicking my heels and just not knowing what was going on. Then I got a call from Ozzy on the internal, you know, intercom phone, said, oh, I'm over at Tony's, you know, the inventor of Turbo Sound. Come over here, and, you know, I want to talk to you. So I went over there, and he looks at me, you know, with the typical Ozzy, you know, he goes, this bloke's not doing it, is he? And I said, well, I'm afraid I don't think he is. Maybe he's not the right guy, whatever, you know. And he goes, can you do it? And I said, yeah, I can do it. He goes, all right, you're doing it then. And then I said, oh, okay. So it wasn't really any change in money or, or, you know, I wasn't elevated to the, you know, to the level of super producer immediately, but at least I got to, you know, make it sound how I thought it should sound. So, and then I guess he spoke to Chris and, you know, said, you know, basically said, oh, it's not working out, you know.
So, and, so let me ask you this, Max. So we all know that at this point in Ozzy's career, coming out of Sabbath, he was, you know, he really had to be, essentially resuscitated in life. I mean, he had been so damaged in drugs and alcohol and such a mess, and we all know that story. And then he gets to this point, and this tremendous material comes in, and this tremendous band with Lee Kerslake and Bob Daisley and Randy Rhoads, and now you're coming in to kind of save the day as a producer. How did you find Ozzy at that time? Because it was such a rough time in his life, and he was trying to reestablish himself. Was he very lucid? Was he together? Was he sharp by the time he started making this record? Or did you still have to really work to pull from him?
No. Well, you know, it's kind of, you know, a lot of people think that people have all these different views of Ozzy. And my view of Ozzy is that he is mostly very lucid. And he's a very smart guy, and he's a very funny guy. And I think that some of it is a little bit of a smokescreen.
Mm-hmm.
When he doesn't want to be bothered with people, he kind of, you know, he burbles a bit, you know, whatever.
Interesting.
But to be honest, I've got to tell you, to be honest, when I see him now, he's exactly the same as when he was then. He's always been kind of like that. And he's like, you know, book this, he hasn't really changed to me, which is, quite kind of astonishing. But he's a lot more lucid than he seems. And people just think he's like out of it, but he's not out of it. And I don't know if that's on purpose or just by accident or just by design or just by habit, But no, the guy's very smart. And I've got to tell you, as a singer, yeah, top-notch singer. He was a top-notch singer in those days, and he's still pretty good. And for considering how long of a career he's had, I mean, the guy really is a really good singer, and that's really probably, what's going on behind everything else. You know what I mean? So he wasn't difficult to work with at all. And basically, of course, floating on top of this massive talented band, that all of a sudden just seemed to fall together. And I wasn't there at any of the rehearsals or any of that stuff. And I only have a production credit on there because Frank Andrews called Sharon and said, I think you should give him a production credit. You know what I mean? So in the production sense, I didn't do any work on those arrangements or anything like that. It's really just surely as a bouncing board for them to try stuff and go, what's that like and stuff like that, as more as an engineer than as a producer on the first record, certainly. So let me
ask you this. So obviously the other big question here is even though Randy Rhoads had a history in Southern California and made a couple records with Quiet Riot, for the world, Blizzard of Oz was the introduction for the most part to Randy Rhoads. Was this your first introduction to him? Were you aware of him prior? And tell me what it was like recording guitar sounds and recording Randy Rhoads on that first record. I mean, what were your impressions? Were you floored? I mean, take us inside of that, because that, you have a unique vantage point of having recorded him on what many people heard him for the very first time on Blizzard of Oz.
There's a few questions in there. Okay. So the first thing is, no, never heard him before. So had no idea who he was or what he'd done before. Didn't know he was in Quiet Riot, actually, until after the second record, probably. Didn't really pay attention to that. Somebody asked me the other week, they posted online, what was it like to watch Randy playing his solos? And I had to say, look, I don't watch people playing solos. I don't watch any artists. I listen to the artists. Because if I watch them, that's going to color my impression of what they're doing. Because when you look at somebody playing these kind of solos, you're blown away. I mean, you can't help but be blown away. The shit is just magical stuff. But if you're not looking, you're just hearing it, then you can be a lot more analytical. And the job as engineer and engineer/producer is to provide accurate, fast feedback after the tape. In these kind of overdub situations. So the guy's in the zone, you're in the zone, the guy plays the solo, you stop after the solo, and he goes, what's the story? Or you don't let him say what the story is. You say, okay, third section, there's a blur on that note. Okay, you missed this one. Rest of this, pretty good. And that's really when you get into the zone, and that's what the artist wants, actually. They want somebody who's not impressed. They want somebody who's giving them vital and honest feedback, and they want it fast, and they want it accurate. And that's what you get into. That's the zone that you get into. So that's the zone that I would work with Randy. And we would he would rehearse these solos, especially many, many times. I would make him a tape loop on a half-inch tape, a mix of the track 15 seconds before and 15 seconds after the solo section. And I would make about 15 or 18 of these on a big, long, 10-inch or 12-inch reel on a two-track. And then he would be able to play that and then go and sit on his stool in the studio, and we had a big pair of tannoys down there that he could monitor on, and with his, obviously amp coming through there, and he would sit there, and we would go up to the pub for an hour or two after dinner, and he would just be sitting in there, and then we'd get back, and I'd poke my head in and go, and sort of just like, you know, nod my head at him, and he'd go, you know, half an hour. And then I'd come back at 9 o'clock or 9:30, and he'd be like, okay, let's start trying it, you know. So then we'd start, you know, putting it down. And of course, the other thing that was extraordinary with Randy was that once we got the right feel and the right notes and everything sat correctly, then he would double it again. So that we could spread that correct track out to the left and right of the speakers. And one of the things that bothered me when this was remixed and re-recorded, which it has been countless times, I have no idea, but one of the things that bothered me was that I'm not sure that the guys who remixed it knew which track was the lead track of Randy's solo. And this is actually very important because this is the one that had the correct feel. And the other ones were meant to be ghosted back left and right and not meant to be to impinge as the main solo. So one of the things that always worried me was that I'm not sure that that was ever put right when they, first of all, they replaced the bass and drums, then they took them off again. And, you know, I know we talked about this. I won't get into it in too much detail there because I know we don't want to get sued again,
right.
But, you know.
Thankfully, the good news is that the madness of re-recording and remixing those two iconic records has been shifted back because the original versions are once again restored, to my knowledge. So although some people may have those in their collection, even Ozzy said in his own book that he didn't approve of that being done and was glad that it was restored to the original recording.
Yeah, and you know, okay, so maybe we can clear this up a little bit because, funnily enough, today I was listening to the Boneyard, funnily enough, and they were playing Crazy Train. And okay, so my original mix of Crazy Train, right at the beginning, he goes, oi, 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 right?
Right.
He does that. Okay. So the way Ozzy sings, he sings one line and then he doubles that line. So the way it goes, I'll give you a rundown how it goes with an Ozzy singing session. You go, okay, first line, Oz, you run the track, you punch him in. He sings the first line. You stop. He goes, how was it? You go, yeah, not bad, Oz. He goes, do it again. You play it again. You punch him in again, same line. How was it? I like that one, Oz. Double it. Put him on another track, play it again. He doubles it because he just sang it, so he can double it real close. How was it? A little wide, Oz. Okay, do it again. How was it? Good. Sounded good, that one, Oz. All right, next line. So vocal take about 5-6 hours, maybe a little longer. We get a little slower towards the end if he's nipping at a bottle of Jack or a bottle of Scotch or, you know, something like that. But that's how he does the vocals. And okay, so we're doing Crazy Train, and all of a sudden, we're doing the first line. So I'm playing this from like kind of the intro, the beginning of the intro, the whole riff. So he goes, "Oi!" So I'm kind of laughing. I leave it on there. You know, because you never, you try and keep everything, basically. So I leave it on there, and he sings the first line. He goes, oh, how was it? I go, good, Oz. He goes, all right, double it. So I'm coming from the beginning of the song again, and he hears this, oi, and he goes, oi, after it. And so we start laughing, and then we decide to put one more on there. So it goes, oi, oi, oi. So it was kind of a serendipity. It was kind of a mistake, actually. He was supposed to double the oi, but he didn't. He did it in the wrong place. So but then we added another one to make it not seem like a mistake, you know.
Right.
So the whole point of the story is that I listened to it today, and it must have been, it must be a remix, because it went oi, 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 oi. And it's what we call a ping pong echo. It's left, right, echo, oi, left, oi, left, oi, right. Okay. So I didn't do that on the original mix. I thought about it, and I thought it was a little more organic to just leave him doing the three oi's. So if you hear it with that ping pong echo left, right, then it's a remix for sure, because I didn't do that. So that's what I'm trying to work out, because I heard that today, and it wasn't loud enough for me to tell whether it was the original drums or bass or not. So I'm really not sure. But it was on the Boneyard, and it was today. So I don't know which version they're playing.
Yeah.
But it'd be interesting. It'd be interesting to find out, you know.
Yeah, it would be what was ingested into the system, and maybe there's a, you know, it does have to be revised or updated, or it is, you know, the wrong version. There is some of that in the databases there that were ingested a long time ago that absolutely should be revised if that's the case. But I'll see if I can find out for you. You know, I kind of, there's so many other records, and I obviously we could do a whole show just on the Ozzy records. And I do want to spend a little more time, because you did do Ozzy stuff beyond the first two records. But, you know, I'm curious, just in the interest of time, and so we can get to some other artists, were you aware, Max, when you're doing these first two records, did it strike you how timeless and special that they would be? That hearing Randy Rhoads, did it hit you at that time that, wow, this guy is going to be a generational talent that is going to be, even in his tragically short life, super influential? Like, did you acknowledge recording him, that what you were recording was going to be as iconic for the long run as it's turned out to be?
Well, you know, that I get asked that quite a lot, and the answer is no, absolutely not. You have no idea at the time. Maybe you have 10% of a feeling that, you know, yeah, this is good. I mean, basically, you're happy that the stuff is going well, and you're happy that they're playing the songs good, and you're happy that the songs are good, and you're happy that the lyrics are happening, and you're happy, you know, so you're really just happy. And like I was trying to explain before, you get into the zone. So you're really inside the bubble, and you have no idea really whether it's going to work or whether it's not going to work. I mean, you make it the best you can. You do the absolute best you can. But at the end of the day, it's not possible to know the impact, you know. And, of course, hindsight is 20/20, of course. But at the time, no, we didn't know, you know. We basically, I think Ozzy got like £35,000 for leaving Black Sabbath. And I think that was the money that he came to Ridge Farm with at the time. And it was very inauspicious, actually, the whole thing. Everybody was very, you know, pretty laid back. Everybody was very ordinary. No rock star stuff at all. Even Ozzy came walking in, and I didn't actually know who he was. I thought he was the road guy. I thought he was one of the road crew. And I said, "Hey, man, are you going to say?" And I go, "Oh, go sit in the control room and making some tea." He goes, "All right, you know." We're just, you know, it's just sort of everybody's just hanging out, and the fire only started when that band got in there. And that, you know, I got to tell you, Eddie, that was a good fucking band, really, really good band.
Yeah.
And you know, and that's the end of it. Listen, you know, you don't have to be a good engineer if it's a good band. You just got to press record. That's the thing, you know. I mean, they're really, really good band. So But at the time, you don't know. No, you hope, and sometimes you think, "Oh, you know, that, you know, this wasn't like somebody else who was well known, and you're doing another record that's gonna be big." You know what I mean? It wasn't one of these sort of right. records that you do that where they're already established. You know, you've got a chance of like me doing, for instance, like doing Countdown, for instance. You know. We knew that was going to be a big record at the time. We knew, because we knew what had happened to the previous album. All the stars were aligned. We worked very hard on the material and the whole concept. Dave, exemplary worker on that stuff. Amazing lyrics and and great ideas. And, you know, that was another fantastic band. So, you know, when you've got a band like that with a history, that you've got some chance of you know, picking up something good. But with Blizzard of Oz, the original one, no idea. And, you know, so.
Well, we're going to get to Megadeth, and that's the only reason why I want to move forward is because I do want to talk about other things, because you do have an impressive resume beyond Ozzy. It's funny, a two-hour radio show, and there's still never enough time when you talk to people who have the stories and the insights you do about so many of these records that we love. But I want to just button up a couple quick things with Ozzy and just get some real quick stuff from you on a few other fronts, and then we want to move on to the rest of, or just some other parts of your resume. So I had asked you this. You were on, I called in, because we were having a debate on this show, Ozzy, Diary versus Blizzard, what's the better record? You produce both of them. What was the biggest difference between making Diary and Blizzard? Now, Blizzard had success. There was a track record. You had had experience with the band. I imagine that was a big factor. I imagine there was a whole different level of confidence with that same band going into doing the second record.
Actually, yes, that's a very astute comment, and it's absolutely true. We all had to... funnily enough, we're just finished doing Rough Diamond with Bad Company, and they were just moving out of the studio, and they were actually moving their equipment out. Their guys were moving their equipment out as we were starting Diary of a Madman. And I remember feeling a great sense of sort of warmth and homeliness that all these guys were coming back in, and we were going to start on another, you know, on another album, because we had a really good time on Blizzard. And you know, I mean, the thing was, it was only 3 weeks. So, you know, from start to finish, Blizzard was really made in about 3 weeks and 2 days, maybe. So having them come back in made me feel very good. And everybody was very up, because, Blizzard was doing really well, and everything was working. So we did have a lot of confidence. We had a lot of confidence in each other. There was no trepidation in my mind about Ozzy singing, about anybody's performance, about Randy's playing. Everything was just, you know, all green light. So I think that does play into how... We started to do work on that second record. I tried to expand my side of it, getting Randy different sounds, you know, working on the space inside the track more, as opposed to it being sort of more like, I mean, Blizzard of Oz, there's a couple of tracks on there are actually rough mixes. Because I couldn't get them any better. So, you know, the way that was done, there's no real embellishment particularly, and it's a very rough and ready kind of record, and which is one of the strengths of it, obviously. And there were a couple of tracks on there that I tried to mix them again, and I just couldn't catch the same kind of feeling that I had on the rough mix. So I said to Ozzy, I said, look, I can't do better than this mix. I think this mix is good. And he goes, fine, we'll keep it. You know, so when we have that level of confidence with everybody, and everybody trusted everybody else, and, you know, everybody, you know, we trusted that Ozzy would be able to do the vocals, and we trusted that, you know, everybody would play their parts. And everybody expanded, I think. Mentally on that record, everybody started to expand. I think Randy was better at what he was doing. He'd done more lessons. He'd done a bunch of touring. He'd done a lot more playing. And I mean, that guy played every day for hours and hours. So, you know, every week he got better. So by the time he came back for the second record, this was all everything actually just started to look like it was in a different league, and actually it was in kind of a different league. So that record took a turn for the more kind of, you know, produced kind of sound, a bigger kind of sound. You know, the whole thing with the orchestrations and, the choirs and all this kind of stuff. And actually recently, I just must mention, RIP to Louis Clark, who did a lot of the orchestral arrangements, who I believe died in February. And I didn't realize that. I just heard that the other day. So rest in peace, Louis. And just one story I want to tell about Louis. We went to Abbey Road to cut the strings for Diary, and we were in Abbey Road downstairs, which is where the Beatles did the White Album, and it's the same console, and we had the London Symphony string section out on the floor, 26-piece strings, and we had Louis Clark from Electric Light Orchestra, who did all the arrangements for those guys, and he did the arrangements for that, and we're sitting there, and the session was due to start at 10 o'clock, and it was 10:15. Louis wasn't there, and everybody's looking at their watches, and we've got this three-hour session booked. And Louis comes walking in at 10:17 with two pints of beer, one in each hand, and goes, "Where's the copyist?" And because we didn't have like copy machines in those days, so you'd actually have a guy writing these dots out. So this bloke at the back held his hand up, and Louis went, "Right." He put both his pints down. He sat down at this little coffee table, and he pulled out a bunch of stave, music paper with stave on it, you know, music paper. And so he starts just writing the stuff out. I mean, it's like Amadeus, you know. The guy just starts writing it out. And he finishes one page, and he just skims it over to the copyist. The copyist grabs it and he starts copying it out. And then Louis is on the second page and he starts copying it out. And damn, about 10 minutes later, he's like, "Right, let's go." He grabs a baton. The copyists go, they run out there, they start putting these papers on everybody's, you know, music in front of everybody. And bam, to about 10:45, we start doing a run through. And I was like, I'm absolutely astonished. Absolutely astonished. And we're all just sitting there. I'm looking at Ozzy, and we're shaking heads like, "What the fuck is going on?" I mean, we've just nobody, you know. And I wasn't actually doing the engineer because I said, "Look, I don't know how to do this. You guys got to do it." They're like, "Don't worry about it. It's going to be fine," you know. And I was like, we're absolutely astonished. Well, and you know what, Louis, wherever you are now, mate, that was like the funniest fucking thing I ever saw. It was really, really great. And we were all just absolutely astonished. It was the most marvelous thing. We walked out of there with a couple of double tracks of this, and that was it. And that was that's the whole string thing.
Amazing.
And it was done in a couple of hours. And then we all went outside and tried to walk across that, you know, zebra crossing that they have, you know, to make it, you know, taking pictures, you know, looking like the Beatles, you know.
Right.
But, you know, just an amazing thing. Anyway, I just want to say that about Louis because I don't know if anybody really, nobody ever said anything about him up to me anyway, but I always thought the guy was a brilliant guy. You know, so.
Yeah, no, it's important to get those stories out and these people that were vital to making these records and the stories behind them that maybe don't get that recognition. One real quick thing on Randy, and then I want to ask you a few things about Bark at the Moon. So with Randy, this is the eternal question, and you would be the one to know. What was there anything that he did that you recorded on either of those two sessions for Diary or Blizzard that has not come out? Do you know if there's the existence of material of him playing or any sort of songs? Was there anything you recall recording during those first two records of him that's never seen the light of day?
This is another question that does come up quite a lot. And, in fact, the question came up in a big way when we were doing tribute, and Ozzy calls me up. He goes, you know, because we got that tribute show, and I already spoke about that with a bunch of other guys, and I think it was a King Biscuit hour, whatever it was, and it was only I think an hour and 6 minutes, maybe. So it was only three sides of an album. So then the obvious thing was like, what are we going to do with the last side? You know, because in those days you would never send out an album with like a blank side, you know.
Right.
So So the only thing that we had really to put on that last slide was the stuff from D. And the question you just asked me was the same question that Ozzy and Sharon kept asking me over and over and over again. You know, what have we got as outtakes? And we don't have any outtakes because we did exactly what we had to do, and because we didn't have time for anything else, really.
Right.
So to my knowledge, no, there's nothing else. As far as Rich Farm and stuff that I work with, Randy, as far as I know, there's nothing else there. I do get asked quite a lot for people to remix it without the fade so they can hear the last few notes of Brandy's outro solos. And, that it was the same with that, actually, is that we made those fades as long as we possibly could to keep everything. So if there's two notes after the end of those fades, you know, I would be surprised, because we faded them as long as we possibly could.
Let me
I just want to say that was one of the things that Ozzy said to me right at the beginning of Blizzard. Ozzy said, he said, listen, keep all his rough stuff, keep all his rough solos. And of course, because we only had 24 tracks, the solos themselves, the rough solos, were probably erased. But a lot of those end solos that you hear were done on the backing track at the time. They weren't overdubs. They were actually done probably as the band were, you know, winding out.
So just in the interest of time, because I want to wrap up the Ozzy portion here, and we could, I mean, I love Speak of the Devil, which is the live record done at the Ritz, which you also produced. That was with Brad Gillis on guitar doing the Sabbath stuff. So I don't mean to gloss over this stuff, but I do love these records. But I do have to ask you, Bark at the Moon, obviously a great record, but obviously a huge change because Randy's not there and in comes Jakey Lee. Your recollections about making Bark at the Moon and your impressions of Jakey Lee coming in as a replacement and working with him?
Yeah, it was a tough time, obviously. When I say about, you know, them coming back in for Diary, and the whole feeling about that was just a very, very, very 100,000% positive feeling. And then coming in for Bark at the Moon was had a whole different feel about it, obviously. And different band, you know. So, it was very tough for Jake. But Jake, very capable at that time, played very good, did the job really well, and did a lot of great writing. And there was some, you know, some later problems with all that stuff with Jake. And having just worked with Jake on some stuff the last couple of years, you know, he's still very bitter about that whole that whole time. But it came out pretty good. At the end of Bark at the Moon, we kind of ran out of studio time, and we had to fly over to New York to mix, and it was very rushed. We mixed, I think, in 4 days, myself and Bob Daisley, and nobody liked the mix. I didn't like the mix that much either, but we did the best we could in the time allowed. Everybody was pretty burnt out at that point. It was a lot of hard work. There was a lot more work actually doing that record than Diary, but I'm not really sure why, but I mean, I like the record. It's a good record, and I love Jake, and he played really great. But it was a bit of a struggle, that record. And then at the end of the record, I didn't really like the mixes that much, but I took them over to master at Master Disc, and then I couldn't get Bob Ludwig. I had to use Howie Weinberger, and I got nothing against Howie, but I always used to use Bob, and I didn't really like how it sounded with Howie, and I don't know, something didn't quite click on that. And then Ozzy and Sharon basically didn't like it either, so they fired me at that point. And then they had Tony Bon Jovi, of all people, remix it at the Power Station in New York, and that was even more horrendous than my mixes, I thought. But you know, it's okay. I mean, at the end of the day, Joe, both Jake and I were kind of upset with the amount of keyboards, but his playing on there still comes through, and I think at the end of the day, it's a really nice record, and it's got some great songs, and you know, Jake worked very hard on that. And I think he had a better time on the one after that. But then, of course, everything kind of fell apart with him and Ozzy and Sharon as well. So, it was tough. It was very tough. You know, it wasn't, of course, there was always the spectre, Randy's spectre kind of, you know, hovering there, you know. And you know, as much as you don't want to think about it, it's still kind of the elephant in the room, you know.
Sure, no doubt. Well, listen, I could talk to you again about Ozzy the entire rest of the show and these records, but you obviously have a career and a resume beyond that, and we really, at this point, only have about a half an hour left, and I want to dive in and get some quick stuff from you on some of these other great bands and records that you've worked on. In the interest of time, I want to move forward and just get some quick stuff from you on these records, if I can. One of my favorite bands, and I think a band tremendously underrated still, is Y&T. And you did an amazing record with them called Black Tiger, which was actually their fourth record overall, but their second under the name Y&T. We talk about guitar players. I think Menichetti is one of the truly underrated great ones out there. Phenomenal singer as well. And sadly, from the band that made Black Tiger, only Dave is still alive, which is just hard to believe. Tell me about working with Y&T briefly and your recollections about that record.
Dave's just amazing. And I went to see him, I think, two or three years ago over at, in New York at, BB King's, which is now closed, but,
I saw you there.
Oh, that's right. You did. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, the guy's just mind blowing. I mean, his singing and his playing is just—he's mind blowing, and I don't know—he's pushing—he's pushing the—he's pushing the ears now, and the guy still sings like a bird. I was so overjoyed to see him, and I thought I thought that band was great. But as you say, yes, Phil's gone. Lenny was probably one of the best rock drummers ever been out there. Actually, Lenny Hayes. I mean, that guy was a monster, and that's a godsend to an engineer to have a drummer like that, because that guy just smacks it as hard as he possibly can, every hit. And that's really what you want if you're doing that kind of music. And he was marvelous. It was a great band, really good band. And we rehearsed up in San Francisco over in Oakland. And that was a pretty, horrible area. It was I can't remember where it was, but anyway, so we rehearsed there for a while, and then they wanted to do, we came back over to England to do it at Ridge Farm, and they didn't have any work permits or anything like that. So I remember we got to Heathrow, and we were all standing in different lines to try and look inconspicuous. And then I went through first because I had a British passport, so I was okay. And then I got called over the loudspeakers, you know, Heathrow, oh, come to the, you know, immigration. And I went to immigration, and they had them all sitting there on a bench, you know, like the usual suspects, you know. And then this guy was like, "What's going on?" I said, "What do you mean?" He goes, "Look," he said, "Look, you stand out like a sore thumb, all you guys." He said, what's the story? What are you doing? I said, well, the band's coming over. They're going to, you know, record an album. Oh, yeah? Oh, really? Oh, is that what, you know? So it was one of those, you know, typical British kind of cockney guy, you know, giving you crap about stuff. But eventually I had to let him in, you know. So it took him a couple of hours to get him in through immigration, because they were like, oh, well, where's the work permit? You know, what are you doing? But it turned out that legally, if we're exporting the music back to America, it didn't matter. So I don't know what happened there, really. But, so that was the first thing. And then we got to the studio, and everything was pretty good. We were trying to I know that we were using remote wireless guitars at that point. And we had a lot of problems with batteries and getting enough batteries and stuff like that. So that was a bit of a problem with Dave, you know, with his with the guitars. And that was one of the first times that we started doing guitar solos in the control room at Ridge Farm. Actually, you know, Dave would just stand right behind the console and do all his solo. So that was an interesting concept. And the other thing that happened one night was we were sitting there talking about Randy, because I think one of the reasons they wanted to go there was because of the history of the place and everything. And there was this massive storm going on outside, big thunderstorm. And all of a sudden, this lightning bolt, right after we were talking about Randy. I'm talking about it, Randy, to Dave. And all of a sudden, there's this big bang and all the lights go out. And we kind of like flick a lighter, you know, and hold it up, and we're looking at each other. We could just see each other's eyes, you know. We're like, holy shit, what the hell, you know. It's like we kind of got a little spooked. And then finally we got the power back on, and I guess lightning had hit the pole across the street. And I went back and pulled out the fuses out of the power amps, and they were all like totally like, they just totally the wire inside the fuse had just vaporized and coated the inside of the fuses. So,
oh wow!
I don't know. So we didn't talk about Randy too much after that. We got a little scared about that, but we thought that was a little weird. But yeah, what a fantastic band, and yep. We had a lot of fun with that. And I'm in there somewhere. I think I'm the toucan at the beginning of Black Tiger.
Oh, that is awesome. Again, just in the just in the interest of time, I'm just moving a little more quickly because there's just so much I want to hit you with, and we don't have that much more time. But I want to get a little something on some of my other favorites. Now, I love. Sure. Unfortunately, Coney Hatch is a band that is very off the radar in America. But I at least want to mention the Out of Hand and Friction. Phenomenal records. I love that band. I wish they would have made it in the U.S. They're still around. I still talk to Andy from time to time. Phenomenal band. Phenomenal sounding records you made with them. I love that group. I would encourage anybody who is not familiar with them to seek those records out. But just in the interest of time moving forward, you worked with Loudness on Thunder in the East, which was their American breakthrough, Lightning Strike, Soldier of Fortune, three records with that band. And I mean, Akira is just ridiculous guitar player as well. I imagine for you, unbelievably challenging producing a band that doesn't really and didn't really have a grasp of the English language. How were you able to do that?
That was the main hurdle. Was the accent and the lyrics, etc. Obviously, Akira, not a hurdle at all, a pleasure to work with, and actually quite easy to work with the whole band. I only had to learn about five phrases in Japanese to be able to work with them. And but the lyrics and the vocals were a real were a problem. And we did have some lyricists working on that stuff. I wrote some lyrics, had all kinds of stuff. I tread a little warily on that because they don't as because of the Japanese, the way the Japanese think, they don't particularly like to be shown to be not good in that regard. So I don't want to insult them and say that it was, you know, that they were helped or whatever, but we did have lyricists. We did try. There's a lot of coaching going on to make things sound okay. You know what I mean? Might have to punch one word maybe a few times to try and get the pronunciation right and stuff like that. Despite the fact that we worked very, very hard on getting the pronunciation right, if you listen to it now, it's very obviously a Japanese singer, but it seemed to get enough over, you know, towards sort of between the halfway across the Pacific at least, that people kind of accepted it. And, you know, the worst sort of comments we get are sort of lock and roll, crazy, like, you know, whatever, you know, confusing the R and the L. But for the most part, everybody seemed to like it. It kind of hit a it kind of hit a sort of a soft streak in America for some reason, and it worked quite well, you know, Rock and Roll Crazy Nights, and
yeah,
and they were a very, very good band, and Higuchi, you know, unfortunately he died probably over 20 years ago now, but Munetaka was what a fantastic drummer, really, really great guy. They're all great guys, and they're all really good, really, really good players. So once again, a great band, you know, and really the only hard task, as you say, as you rightly point out, with the vocals and getting the vocals right. And it always was a hard task. And in fact, it came to a point on the third record where Mickey got, you know, replaced, because I think the band just kind of lost patience. And then they got I forget his name. What's his name?
Mike Vassera.
Mike's a real good singer too. But that kind of that changed the band somewhat as well. So you know, great band. Yeah, and Akira, and still going strong too. Akira's still going. And
I still see them. I still see them from time to time when they're able to get into the country because they've had visa issues. But when they're able to get here, whether it be on the Monsters of Rock cruise or what have you, and they've gotten way heavier. But Akira is just one of those guys you could just watch. He's remarkable to watch and listen to. He's just incredible. When it comes to Megadeth, Max, you produced Countdown to Extinction and Euthanasia for them. You had mentioned in reference this a little bit earlier, that was a different situation because now you're coming in and getting involved with a band that is already well-established, had a great band together, had a large degree of success. And it sounds like earlier from your comments that you had a wonderful experience working with Dave Mustaine, who, of course, as we all know, as there's people that love and people have had difficulties with. All good as far as you're concerned working with Dave and Megadeth?
Well... you know, you go from, you know, there are various things that happen with Dave. I mean, the reason I say that about Countdown was because I mixed the previous record, and that got very well received and did very well. And for that reason...
So you mixed, you mixed Rust in Peace. I didn't realize that.
Yeah, Rust in Peace and... That worked out very well. So the story behind that, I got a call one day. Mike Clink called me up, and he's a Guns N' Roses producer, among others, of course. And he called me up and said, look, I got to go do Guns N' Roses. I need somebody to mix this. So, you know, why don't you come over here? So I went over to Rumbo Recorders, which is where they were doing Studio A, and I walked into the billiard room, and I think David Ellison and Mustaine were playing billiards and playing snooker or whatever. And Mike Clink walks in and he goes, okay, there's no points. So I looked at him, I go, okay. He goes, you know, so it's like, you know, 10 grand, mix the record. I go, all right. So, you know, I went over to One-on-One in North Hollywood and we got the tapes over there. We started mixing and Mike does lots and lots of edits. So that I had to do quite a lot of shenanigans to get around some of these edits because the snare would be totally different in the verse than it was in the chorus, and kind of things like that. And Dave was in one of his more problematic periods at that point, and he was actually okay with me. He would just walk in and we'd talk about a few things and he would listen. And so at that point, it was not real problem. And I had quite a good time working with him. So when it came to Countdown, he sent me a big cassette of a whole bunch of songs, Countdown songs, and I listened to them for a couple of days, and I didn't have a clue what to do with them, actually. And I was like, oh, shit. I don't, you know, and he's waiting for me to send him, you know, my notes or whatever on all the material. And that was it. That was the time I realized another sort of rule to live by, if you like, for producers is if you don't know what to do, you just haven't listened long enough. So I just kept listening, and about halfway through the third day of listening to this material, I started to get some ideas and I started writing them down. And by that end of the third day, I'd written down about four or five pages of notes, and I sent them over to Dave, and I didn't hear back for a couple of days. And then my wife at the time called up the stairs and said, "Oh, it's Dave Mustaine's on the phone." And I was like, "Oh, there we go. He's gonna go off on me probably." And I picked up the phone and said, "Hey," and he goes, "Hey," he said, I got your notes." And I said, "Okay." And he said, "I agree with 99% of them." and I was like, "Oh shit!" And I was like, "Oh, you know." So I was kind of like, I was extremely surprised because I thought it's probably going to go, this ain't going to work, you know. So that's what started that off. And then we went into the next decision we made on that record was that we were going to do it digital. And we had Sony at this point had a 24-track digital on half-inch tape, which was a really, really good sounding machine and was the first of the real decent digital sounding machines. And the great thing about that was that we could do very, 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 very accurate punches. And we could get very accurate with it. So we started to work on the record in the Enterprise and with the digital. And we realized very, or I said very quickly, I said, "You know what? We want to make this more accurate. I think it's a little sloppy still." And Dave looked at me, he goes, "You know what? You're right. So we got to make it way more accurate." So that became kind of the tenet behind everything, to make that record really kind of a, if you like, the Steely Dan of metal, if you like, or whatever. But to make that record really that kind of record, to make it just a really, really astonishingly accurate record, and couple that with Dave's character on the vocals over the top. And just the exemplary playing of Nick Menza and Dave Ellison and then adding Marty to this mix is just, I mean, you live and pray for this kind of band, you know. So there was a very funny story actually. I had Marty in there one day very early on, and we were talking about the whole, you know, accuracy thing, and everybody was into it, and we were all like, "Yeah, let's make it really, really, you know, tits accurate." And I was talking to Marty one day, and I had my back to the door, and I said to Marty, I said, "You know what, man? I said, you're going to do most of these solos because you're that guy." And Dave Mustaine walked in right behind me as I was saying it. And I looked around at him, and of course I had to kind of brazen it out, you know, and have some balls. You know, I just looked around at him, and he looked at me, and he goes, "Yeah," he said, "You're right."
Wow.
And he ate it right there, and I was like, "My God!" So I got a lot of respect for Dave. You know, he can be a dick like everybody else, but you know, a lot of the times that guy, I mean, he's a super, super intelligent guy. So you know, you really can't mess with Dave much. But, you know, he was magnanimous enough at that point to go with it. And it paid off in spades, I think. I mean, Marty's solos on that record, just once again, they're like kind of magical stuff, you know, once-in-a-lifetime stuff, you know. And the great thing about it was that we had the wherewithal where Marty could play the whole solo and get it almost right. And if there were two notes that were wrong, we would make a window punch of like 322 milliseconds and just pop those two notes in. And I would just program that up. And I'd say, "Okay, play along." And he would just play the same solo, and the thing would just go, could just pop in, pop out. And we used that window punching all over the place. In fact, even with Nick Menza, I had him play the drums all the way through with no fills. And then we would go back and program the punches for each fill, and we would write each fill. Wow. And then we would punch each fill until it was perfect, and then we would move to the next fill. So we did that really with every aspect of that record. So it's a really, really accurate record, and you could only do that with guys that are that good, you know. And all that band, David Ellison, all those guys, were that good, and that, it was, that's why it was possible. So, you know, that was a really marvelous thing. And then, of course, we went on to Euthanasia, and that's a whole different story with that, building the studio out in Phoenix and just nutty stuff, you know. So
let me get a few minutes from you on another classic record that is so highly regarded and somewhat controversial. They actually completely re-recorded it recently as an alternate version. I don't even know if you're aware of that, but I'm talking about the Lynch Mob record, Wicked Sensation. You've worked with some incredible guitar players, and you've worked with some guys that some perceive to be difficult and what have you. Correct me if I'm wrong. The story I heard about Wicked Sensation was that some of that record actually ended up being the demos that you ended up mixing and kind of cutting into that record, and that there were already some issues with the band and drug problems and what have you, and getting a performance out of Oney Logan was difficult at times. Can you set the record straight on making that first Lynch Mob record?
Yeah. Okay. So no, none of them were demos. What happened was, yeah, there was a problem with Oney getting, okay, so it was a weird setup because George wanted me to do the basic tracks, and he wanted Neil Kernan to produce the vocals, but he wanted me to produce the guitar solos and stuff. So that was kind of weird, but I know Neil, and I got on very well with Neil, and but I felt bad for him because Oney was very difficult to work with, and the vocals that he had done on the demos, they had 8-track demos of a lot of these songs. The vocals that he'd done on the demos, he'd done them out in Phoenix at some little hole in the wall place, and they were really good. I mean, they were just great stuff. So we got halfway into that record, and I was doing backing tracks working with George, and we were getting all that stuff going on, and Neil was working with Oney at a different studio. He would go and do vocals at a different studio, and then he would come back over and bring over the vocals, and we'd listen. And it wasn't very happening, and we got almost all the way into the doing everything else in the record, and we still didn't have some vocals. And as a producer, you got to guarantee a result. So at this point, I'm like, holy shit. So I'm looking at these 8-tracks, and I'm like, so some of these 8-track tracks that Oney did are really good. I mean, but unfortunately, they're at a different tempo, and they're in a different key. So I rented Skip Saylor's studio down in South Central, and went down there into their back room, which is like $500 a night or something. And I got a harmonizer, and I got a spreadsheet, and I got a sampler, and I got the 8-track, and I transposed about 6 of those songs, the demo vocals, I transposed them onto the current take in order to guarantee a result, because I figured, you know, hey, maybe this is not going to work. And you did mention drugs there, and there really wasn't that any drugs going on, actually. Maybe some beer drinking going on, but no real drugs going on. Just Oney, for some reason, it wasn't working that well in the studio with Neil. So at the end of the day, we went back to Arizona, where Oney had sung the original vocals, and went back there for him to sing some more vocals. And he went back there a day early, and we got there, and he was already in there singing with the original engineer, the demo engineer guy. And Neil Kernan got very pissed off and said, you know what, this is just like a, you know, spitting in my face, basically. And he basically quit the project. So then I'm sitting there, and I'm like, oh, this is not good, you know, because this is a very expensive project, and we already spent like $500,000. And I was very worried about getting it finished. So I started to do all this work on the 8-tracks, and I pulled these 8-tracks over. And Boney didn't particularly like it, but actually at the same time he kind of did like it, because these were smoky atmospheric vocals, that, like Rain, for instance. Rain is a demo vocal. He sang it again, and nobody liked it. We liked the demo vocal, and actually, out of that, on that Lynch Mob record, there are five of those tracks are demo vocals. Hell Child's a demo vocal. I leave it to you guys to figure out which ones are which, but it was kind of an interesting exercise in engineering to be able to take the vocal. You know, and some of them were two steps away from where they should be, you know, tuning wise, and at a different. So I had a spreadsheet that would calculate the offset on the harmonizer and the length of, you know, the time delay. So it was very complicated, actually, but I managed to kind of mathematic my way through it and put it all back together. We just kept working. That was another one that we just kept working on until we got it as good as we possibly could. And it took a long time to make that record, but I'm very proud of that record. And I think some of George's solos on there are just the most amazing thing. And he is one of the most amazing guitar players ever. And that's always been one of the things I'm very thankful for, is I'm able to work with some of these guys who are just unbelievably talented. And I mean, George just oozes talent. George can play, you know, guitar in his sleep, and it blows away most people. Yeah. You know, it's just a marvelous player.
Still, to this day. Hey, yeah. Max. So, yeah. I mean, we'll have to do a part two at some point, because I'm just about out of time here, but I do have 2 or 3 minutes left, and I want, obviously there's a ton of stuff I skipped, but I do want to give you, in the last 2-3 minutes that I have, the opportunity to promote or mention anything that you're doing now, because you're active in music production again. So in the 2 minutes I have before I have to end, what would you like to tell the audience, and what are you working on now?
Okay. Well, yeah, mostly I'm mixing now. Right now, and you just had her on your show, I think, a couple of times. I'm working on Leader Ford's album.
So, yes.
That's really, I mean, it's really remarkable stuff, and I really like it. We're about halfway through now, working with Gary and Leader on that. So I don't know when that's going to get finished, because things these days seem to take ages. You know, I send a mix back, and then it takes 2 weeks to get any feedback and stuff like that. And right now it's difficult, of course, for Leader, because she's back out on tour. She's a very, very hard, one of the hardest working women in rock and roll, of course, and very, very nice to work with. And the material is excellent, and I'm really very enthused about it, but I can't really say much more because we're only halfway through. So I'm working on that. I do some mastering, and I'm doing some mastering for a band from LA called The Spacing Effect. And they're kind of a little side project of mine that I help them out with. And I'm doing a bunch of mixing for a band called 10 Ton Mojo. That's a local New York band. And they're sort of an up-and-coming, kind of a southern rock boogie band. And they're actually really, really good. And we've been working on that. I've got about 10 or 12 tracks for those guys. So I don't know if it's going to come out as an album, or I think there's been a couple of singles already. So I'm working on stuff all the time. And unfortunately, I have a day job also right now, which I'm trying to get rid of. And, I'll be able to accept more stuff. And there's a lot of stuff out there that I want to start, that I would like to be working with. And so I'm trying to free up more time to be able to do that, you know. There you go. And yeah, we can absolutely do another one.
Yeah, there's so much I missed, and I don't mean to gloss over some of the other records, but there's so many, but obviously in the interest of time, I just don't have the time to do it. So good news is you're in New York, I'm in New Jersey, we're local, and we'll hopefully be able to do this, have you in studio, and maybe, I'm sure the audience would love to ask you some questions, but I'll tell you, and I've said this many times, and it's the truth, as a kid listening to records and paying attention to credits, whenever I saw produced by Max Norman or engineered by Max Norman on that sleeve, I knew it was going to be a great sounding record. And I thank you for all the great work you've done and all the music you've given us, man. It's just timeless stuff. And I appreciate your time here today and being so generous with it.
Well, thanks very much. And you know, I'm just, I'm always enthused that, you know, people listened, you know, and that's really all it's about. And I'm just glad that, glad I was able to be in the right place at the right time. And glad that people are out there and glad that people, you know, get into it. And that's what it's all about. It's all about the music. So, you know, yeah, thanks very much for the kind words. But to be honest with you, mostly it's not me. I just hit record and I happen to be in the right place at the right time. So, you know,
well,
and like I say, when you have these great bands, there ain't a lot you need to do, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, Max, thank you so much. I appreciate the time again. I know we'll be talking soon and, we'll catch up with you some more down the line. Thank you so much.
Yeah. Yeah. I appreciate it. I love being on and it's great to talk to you. I'm glad you're doing well and, we survived the pandemic and maybe next time we'll meet in Vegas, Eddie. What do you think?
You got it. Anytime. You can come my place and hang out for sure. Well, I hope you enjoyed that as much as I did. I love talking to Max. Great stuff. We could easily do another round with him. Appreciate his time. Great stories on so many great records, many of which we have in our collections, no doubt. Thanks for listening. New episodes every Thursday. Make sure you subscribe. Thanks to Joel Pollack. He is the producer of the podcast, as well as Trunk Nation, which you can hear Monday through Friday, 2 to 4 p.m. Eastern Time, live on Volume, Sirius XM Channel 106, with nightly re-airs, 10 to midnight Eastern. And be sure to follow me on social media, at Eddie Trunk. You guys have yourselves a great week. Catch you next Thursday for another all-new episode of the Eddie Trunk Podcast.
Want to make mom's day? Get to your Nordstrom Rack now and score amazing deals for Mother's Day, which is Sunday, May 12th. Find tons of gifts from only $30 at Nordstrom Rack. Fragrance, jewelry, luxury bags, activewear, beauty, and more. Save on Kate Spade New York, Stuart Weitzman, and Ted Baker London. Great brands, great prices. So shop your Nordstrom Rack store today and treat mom to the good stuff from just $30.
Life is a highway, and on it there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy, so go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.